Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Catherine Himes is a technologist and computational linguist, currently serving as a director of product and innovation at Doctors Without Borders. Previously, she worked in leadership positions at multiple technology firms, most recently as the head of international product expansion at Slack and as an advisor at Airtable. She holds an MS in computational and mathematical engineering and an MA in linguistics, both from Stanford. Her writing on language and technology has appeared in The Atlantic, Wired, and The New York Times. Catherine is also a co-founder of Thorny Games, a design studio that explores the stories behind the language we speak. Topics discussed include computational linguistics, project management, localization, field research, and nonprofits. The links to Catherine's LinkedIn account and to other resources mentioned are in the show notes. I would like to welcome to the show this week Catherine Himes, who has had a really interesting career and is now at Doctors Without Borders. And I am so interested to hear how you got there. So Catherine, thanks and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as I always do, I want to start by asking you, how did you find out about linguistics from the earliest age that you can remember?
Ah, such a good question. I remember being fascinated by language in ways that would sneak up on me from when I was really small. My dad, a lot of my interests, I think, started really with my dad. And he was a language teacher and a math teacher. And so both were kind of encouraged just in terms of, you know, the things you would talk about at the dinner table, at home. I at some point really had an awakening, I want to say around middle school, where I found myself kind of compulsively wanting to read about other languages, collect words, collect grammars. There was almost this way of, wanting to decode things. So it felt like it kind of tickled both sides of my brain, something that was a bit more logical, but then something that was just kind of naturally attracted to the aesthetics of language. And I have these example Christmas lists kind of going back that my mother will kind of bring out in terms of our conversation to anyone who will ask around me, you know, requesting a Danish grammar or, you know, a Swahili grammar. It showed up there, I think, even before I had the word linguistics. I wanted to know about the structure of language.
So if for undergrad, though, you did not major in linguistics, was that something you thought about? Or because they have it at UCLA, correct? Don't they?
They definitely do. I minored in it.
Okay.
It's kind of a last minute kind of tag on, I will say. I really found myself, drawn to two different things, both math and language. And since this is a career podcast, I can also include, you know, the messiness of what is, a path that one takes. Originally, I thought that I was going to go into like a medical school or something like it. And so my first major ended up being as a chemist. Luckily, found that I hated that so very thoroughly. So thoroughly. And then I really like found a much happier home within the mathematics department, which was just a total rejection of the physical world up to that point. And then just the farther that I got along in my undergrad career, I just kept on taking language courses just on the side. And I would tell myself, this is just a thing that you like to do. You know, why am I taking Hungarian? Why am I, you know, continuing to study French on the side? And I started taking linguistics courses and eventually had enough of them that I thought, well, you know, I may as well minor. I think the whole time I was doing it, I really didn't, there was a journey of kind of acceptance of realizing that this was like too much of a passion in my life to be able to kind of box it out from whatever my career ended up being.
Yeah. And then you went and you got an MA in linguistics.
Yeah. But before I did that, I got I got an MS in applied math.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, it was really this back and forth that lasted a while. So I went to graduate school and studied applied math and had a great time there. And I was doing it at Stanford, which has a really great linguistics program that is also, you know, very technical. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself, even from within the applied math program, constantly being interested in what was being offered, you know, on the linguistics side. And again, found myself in a similar dilemma to what I was in as an undergrad, and realizing that I wasn't going to be happy just doing applied math. You know, that was a part of myself, that there was a part of myself that was really interested in language, and I needed to figure out how I was going to marry these two.
Yeah. Oh, so interesting. I have definitely talked to other folks during the course of this podcast who had that sort of split thing where it was extreme science on one side and extreme language on the other. And, you know, it marries in a lot of ways. I often talk about my own experience in grad school. So the two areas that I was really interested in were acoustic phonetics on one side, extremely data heavy, sciencey, and sociolinguistics on the other side, which is far squishier. Still science, but you know, those two things, most people would not think they go together. But as I found through studying them, they actually intersect a whole lot. And one thing influences another. So it really is all tied together, the science and the humanity part of it.
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, that's such a good example of how these things can just show up even, you know, within a linguistics department. Mm-hmm. And you'll look at faculty, you know, I ended up going more towards computational linguistics, but like fundamentally, you're asking questions about language. Mm-hmm. Sociolinguistics is relevant, phonetics, all of these things. And, you know, you just get such a you know, wide set of tools and perspectives. I remember taking a neurolinguistics class, and then that being a totally new set of like vocabulary and topics and perspectives on how language happens. If anything, it was a realization that there's so much that linguistics can actually apply to.
Yeah.
You know, previously I had told myself, you know, you're interested in studying languages and then maybe generalizing that a little bit, but like it should stop there. And really ending in a place that actually this is a primary toolkit that I can apply to many, many different things in my life and that I intend to.
Yeah, we see it all the time, right? Like any problem that's coming up is usually a communication problem, just sort of like in the world generally. And you can almost always point to it and go, you know what, you need a linguist for that. That would help out a lot if there was a linguist working on this.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, language is just how we interact with the world, how we convey ourselves to others, you know, how we translate our own thought and internal worlds into something that we can all interact with. And, you know, it's remarkable how much I think even the general public is curious about linguistics. Mm-hmm. It isn't true for every subdiscipline that's the case. But there's just so much there to offer. Well, at the same time, I really empathize with the idea of not knowing exactly how it's going to apply to your future life at any given point in time.
Yeah. When you were in graduate school, as you were finishing your various master's degrees, were you thinking that you were going to stay in academia? Was that an appealing thing to you? Or did you know that you were going to try to go into industry?
You know, I thought that I might go for a doctorate, a doctoral degree there. Mm-hmm. And I considered that path and actually ended up kind of restarting that path much later. I really found myself, especially working in the Bay Area, going to graduate school there, kind of being drawn to industry, because so much of what was happening in technology was also interesting from the perspective of language. Mm-hmm. And I ended up doing, I did a research sort of study abroad program in Hungary for a year. And that was fascinating on so many levels, just in terms of being immersed in another language. But the subject that I was studying was also mathematical linguistics. But I'd say like having a year of doing research really told me that I wanted more hands-on experience out in the world. And when I went back to graduate school, there was an opportunity to do an engineering internship in China at a Chinese company that was facilitated by Stanford. And so I applied and took it up. And so I ended up working within a natural language processing department at Baidu in Beijing over the course of a summer. That was such a contrast experience to just being full-time on research, you know, doing research, but it was in the context of a company, let alone being in China at the time and working on language technology and just learning from such amazing colleagues. And I think that that was the real experience, even within graduate school, that convinced me I wanted to go into industry next.
How interesting. So you're working for Baidu, but do you speak any Chinese languages?
Yeah, not much.
Okay.
So it was a fascinating program where, you know, they really wanted to encourage this kind of exchange. And, you know, there was a reciprocal exchange where students from Tsinghua University came to Stanford. For those of us from the U.S., you know, if you weren't already fluent in Chinese, you took a course that was then designed to kind of help make you functional. But the idea was that it, you know, you'd be working within English. And so I was within a Chinese company, immersed in Chinese, but then my colleagues themselves who were, you know, doing research, publishing research on the international stage, you know, were very fluent in English. So I was able to have an amazing experience, even though my language itself was limited. I did come back after that and then took another year of formal Chinese, you know, on top of my graduate courses, just because it was, such an interesting experience.
Yeah, that's extremely cool. I think it shows back up for a second. A lot of people do think about linguistics as being very language specific, but the more you do in linguistics, the more you realize that a lot of it is cross-language and cross-cultural. And yeah, you can be a person who's a linguist who's working with languages that aren't your native language without knowing them intimately, without having native speaker discourse level of competence in them, because it's language, right? Like it gets processed the same way and you're still trying to do the same thing. So I'm just thinking how cool it is that you were doing that without being like completely fluent.
Yeah. And, you know, doing it within the right context of having help from others, you know, who could offer that. But yes, you know, especially from the computational perspective, even when you're working on Chinese English translation, there's a lot that you can do. There's much that you can do without certainly native level fluency.
Yeah. Oh, so cool. Okay. So since then, I'm just looking at your LinkedIn profile here. You have had what I would call a typical linguist in tech kind of career. Like you've gone from place to place, you've done different things. I can see, you know, you're learning and you're growing and you're doing different things. So can you kind of lead me through the path that you took as you took on these different gigs and move from place to place?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was still in graduate school when I got an opportunity to start as a consultant at a company that was called Facebook at the time, obviously now Meta. It was as part of their search team. And they were building a product called Graph Search. And it was really an opportunity for linguists to work alongside engineers, product managers, designers to build what was hopefully a new way of approaching search, and that, you know, an initiative that Facebook was giving a lot of time and energy into. And that was a very exciting place to be at the time, primarily just because of the reach, because of where I think, you know, where Facebook was as a company, and just because of the colleagues that I was working with, so much to learn from. And so I found myself, you know, kind of still being a student and then being a consultant working part-time and eventually realized that I needed to make a choice. You know, either I was going to mm-hmm. go full-time in one or the other. I decided to go full-time. And that was my first sort of big switch and became a computational linguist at Facebook. And I stayed there for a few years working on search. For a while, I actually tried to finish up my linguistics master's then, doing both at once. Quite tricky, as you'd imagine. Mm-hmm. And it was only a number of years later, really, during the pandemic, when I had a bit more time to myself, that I actually formally finished it. So just to point out, you know, sometimes like there's a lot of nonlinear paths that end up going, and you can finish things in the end. But I at the time really chose work, and I stayed there for a couple of years and found myself kind of increasingly drawn to the role of product manager. Mm-hmm. And that is a switch that I eventually made, especially as I continued on in my career, because product management still lets you be close to the problem. I mean, you kind of own the problem, as sometimes is the way that it's framed. And I was interested in solving language problems, communication problems, mm-hmm. As they showed up, while having a lot more decision-making power than what an individual contributor might, you know, either at the level of a computational linguist or an engineer. And I appreciated just that kind of level of influence, control, and also the ability to shape different kinds of software and operate within a company. So I ended up making a number of let's say stints at different tech companies that were focused on, let's say, social media or language in some way, either in a direct search capacity or eventually really thinking about how to take companies international. Which is a much wider scope, because there you're thinking about, you know, what are the sort of technical sides of actually internationalizing or localizing a product, and you know, what are the business sides and what are the sort of cultural sides of communicating what a product does, supporting a new customer base and user base in a new place, and understanding, you know, these concepts that might have originated, in a particular piece of software that was built in the US, you know, how are we going to really make them feel native and useful in a very different context around the world? And so for a couple of companies, and especially one of my last, let's say, more traditional tech companies was at Slack. And I ended up leading their international expansion into a number of markets, Western European markets, Asian markets, eventually beyond that.
That's extremely cool. When you're doing this, I'm just imagining you in these positions. Did you have a team of linguists, or were you one of the few that was there?
So there were a team of linguists that were very focused on localization in particular. Mm-hmm. And these were colleagues of mine. And I ended up working, especially as a product manager, more directly with both these linguists and the things that they did, as well as engineers, designers, mm-hmm. Business people, like a huge cross section of everything really within a company. And I think it was that just wide scope that was really exciting, and that is kind of very particular to, one, the role of product manager, but even more so, you know, the initiative of internationalizing a product and a business, or localizing it into a new place.
So for you, working with like this team, as you were just discussing, with all the, you know, cross skills and all the rest of it, how did that feel, as opposed to what we typically think of as your work in graduate school, right, where you're kind of working on your own and you have some colleagues and you got your advisor? This really feels like, if it's the kind of thing that you like it's fantastic because you're having communication with so many people. So it sounds like for you, it really jazzed you being able to just work with this incredible cross-section of skills and knowledge.
Totally. Yeah, it is. It was the polar opposite of being being just, you know, an individual that, you know, owns a problem, thinks about it, and, you know, needs to, you know, communicate with maybe one or two people about it over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, so many people, coordination, and, you know, still, you know, opinions about language and communication at the end of the day, both in terms of, you know, what the product is, you know, Slack itself being a, you know, communication medium, especially for work, but the, but also in the questions of, you know, how to localize, and, you know, localization at the level of the, you know, the language that appears in the product, but actually at a level deeper, you know, does this product, you know, work within the context of, let's say, how work happens for Slack, you know, mm-hmm. within a Japanese workplace, and, you know, what are things that we can learn about different kinds of Japanese workplaces that ought to, you know, inform how we think about entering that market. And so one of the things that was always the highlight of working in, you know, internationalization in that way was there is a research component that is done at companies where oftentimes they will go to a local market or a country that they're looking to enter into and do some basic research, often with someone with the title of user researcher. There were a number of research trips that I took to sort of better understand, along with my colleagues, you know, what are the things that are most salient for us in thinking about, let's say, launching a product in Japan, in Indonesia, in Brazil, and how, you know, you might really, get a very different kind of cross section of companies as well as needs and, you know, opinions than what you might be hearing back at HQ. Because, you're really on the ground talking to people about, you know, how this technology shows up in their lives and the actual things that, that they care about. And that, I think, always was the most exciting because it's effectively doing research.
Well, yeah, exactly. As you were saying that, I was just thinking, do you have anthropologists on teams like that when the localization plan is happening? It sounds like you'd need one.
Yeah, you know, and oftentimes another pathway into tech, both for linguists and for anthropologists, is through a role that is typically called user researcher or, mm-hmm. you know, a researcher of some kind of role. And so that is a role that routinely I would partner with as a product manager and someone leading an initiative like this to go into a new market and to lead and to basically use that skill set when it comes to, you know, how to pose questions in a way that we can learn rigorous things from them. You know, what are both quantitative and qualitative methods that we're going to deploy in order to answer a set of questions that we have going in, and how to do field research like this, you know, mm-hmm. in the context of a company. So yeah, definitely always the highlight.
That's really, really cool. And one thing, that I want to make sure that people do understand, just talking about field research, you know, anything that you're doing as part of your master's or even your bachelor's and your PhD, when it comes to research, all of those skills are eminently transferable into industry, right? It's just the way you have to frame it so you can talk about it in a way that employers can understand. But all of the field research that you ever do, even if some of it isn't actually in the field, but it's just gathering information, those are skills that are just priceless out there in the world because a lot of people don't know how to do it correctly. And when you do it correctly, you get great data, and that's incredibly valuable.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's see, you were doing this for a while, working at Slack, very cool. And then eventually you ended up in your current position. So how did that come about?
Yeah, I had worked for, at that point, around 10 years in more traditional tech, being based in the Bay Area, except for some stints where I had gone abroad for work, but always with the intention to come back. And, you know, during the pandemic, I really wanted to think about a more direct way that I wanted to align what I was working on with something that I thought was really going to use tech for social impact very directly. And I wanted to go to a place where I thought that technology itself was going to be aiding some bigger mission. So it wasn't just producing technology as the end goal. And that that also, you know, language and the skills that I had acquired as someone who was thinking about, you know, making different kinds of products that need to be globally accessible, you know, where those skills would be most useful. And I did a bit of soul searching over a period of time, moved out of the Bay Area to Washington, D.C., and ultimately found myself in a conversation with Doctors Without Borders, where they were looking to build up a technology and innovation team within the U.S., that could really think about, you know, what are the kinds of prototyping, you know, new exploration, you know, that could be incubated internally in order to aid a mission, which is really focused on, you know, intervention, medical intervention and support in emergencies all around the world. So this kind of global footprint, the opportunity of technology to sort of aid something bigger than just technology itself, and also just the fantastic people that I met along the way convinced me that that this was the right next move for me. And I've now been my title is Director of Product and Innovation, and I've been at MSF. So that's the acronym from the French name, Médecins Sans Frontières, of Doctors Without Borders, and it's how everyone will refer to it internally and many places externally. I've been there now for, it's 3 or 4 years at this point. So it has been definitely an exciting time to be here. I really love the work and the colleagues, and have like learned, I'd say, a really important and different kind of skill set around deeply interacting and collaborating with people who have very different kind of expertise than I do, especially medical expertise, you know, comms expertise, go on and so on, operational expertise, and then thinking about how technology can aid that, you know, as one part of their toolkit.
Sorry, I have so many questions. I'm just trying to sift them through in my mind. There's the switch from working from a for-profit to a nonprofit structure, which is a thing in and of itself. I've worked with some nonprofits, and the whole hierarchy and how things are done are really, really different. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about just the work environment. You did there just a little bit, but if you could expand on that, I think it would be great, because I have definitely had the experience of chatting with people who felt exactly like you do, like, I want to do something with my skills that actually might make the world a better place. You know, there's technology that's cool and everything, but maybe we could actually do something with all these skills. But working for a nonprofit or a charity or something, or even a government org, is so different from having a job in industry. And you really have to have the right kind of mindset to go into it and be successful. So how did you find that transition from for-profit to nonprofit?
Yeah, it, you know, I have found it to be smoother than I thought it would be. You know, I thought it would be a bigger issue than it has been. And partially, I think, you know, I can only speak to the organization that I have experience with. But I, you know, I think that there was enough of just a concentrated effort around, you know, wanting to explore technology in a new way, that made it so that you can build a team that then can act on and incubate ideas in interesting ways, even if, you know, the team is smaller. And even if the team, you know, is then working within the context of a much, you know, larger or decentralized organization. And I will say, especially in someone who's worked in global expansion before, or in, in other areas of my career in more traditional tech, there's this echo of, this idea that actually, you know, there's one thing to build something, you know, under perfect conditions that can work. And it's a very different thing to actually get technology into the hands of people in a particular place that you want to be using it and have it be useful for them and to deploy it. And then to, you know, sustain its usefulness over time. More and more of my interests lie in actually getting technology into the hands of people that are actually, you know, solving real problems and trying mm-hmm. to do useful things with it. And that is something that is really kind of, you know, you almost, I feel, need to be on the inside of an organization in order to really make that happen. Mm-hmm. It can be very nice to offer as much expertise as possible, you know, from a distance or, you know, and there's a huge value in consulting and all of this. But at least from what I've seen, at the end of the day, if you really want to make change happen, being in the room where these conversations happen mm-hmm. and understanding how decisions are made at these mm-hmm. conversations, I think can really, you kind of need to be all in order to make that work.
And, yeah, 100%. I mean, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but it's all about process, right? Like there is a process to making these things happen. And if you're not part of the process, as you said, you can offer all kinds of advice and stuff like that. But if you're not in the process, it's probably not going to happen.
Exactly.
Except for perhaps my own personal point of view, the current administration making decisions, there's no process happening there. And then we see what happens and things don't turn out very well sometimes. Anyway, so for the benefit of people who are listening, what do you do? Like, what is your job day to day? What kind of responsibilities do you have?
Yeah, I lead a team with engineers on it, a DevOps engineer, data science folks, and we end up taking on projects that are in different stages of maturity that are using technology on behalf of what Doctors Without Borders does. Mm-hmm. And that's a really broad mandate, and it can be made a lot more specific and is made a lot more specific within the kinds of projects that we ultimately end up doing. Sometimes it's prototyping, you know, so that means we have an idea of a use case of a certain piece of technology or something that we want to build internally. We explore it, play around with it. We'll make sort of a toy version of it and then give it to exactly the people that it's tailored for and get their feedback on it, iterate on it, and then make it better and then get it to a point where we let it go. We give it life and mm-hmm. then kind of rinse and repeat and start that over. A lot of our emphasis over the last couple of years, unsurprisingly, has been on AI and just how we think about and explore AI internally at Doctors Without Borders, in what ways we want to apply it to different areas of work, and especially where there's opportunity. And one area where my team has spent some time, and that there's more time in the future, is really thinking about language itself and different ways of approaching translation AI as a way to evaluate how it might aid like the varied translation needs of operating in different places around the world.
Yeah, cool. Can you give an example of a project that you shepherded through that got something into the hands of people, like a really specific example?
I can talk about one concrete thing that that this team has built in the past and is a part of now, which was something that is called the Science Portal. One thing that people might not know about Doctors Without Borders is that it actually does a lot of research, just peer-reviewed research that is published in journals around the world based on the kind of places where their scientists and medical personnel are working and what they learn from being operators in their positions. And one of the problems that the people were finding is just that it was very difficult to actually keep track of all of this research and actually find sort of a one-stop shop and hub for all of it. And there are so many materials that are available at the global level from MSF. And now this MSF Science Portal, which is publicly accessible, at least is a home for people to actually be able to see them packaged as collections, and then also be a conversation point, I think, with the public health community and other people that are doing research. So that's one example of a product that's built by this team. But lots more products that are in stages of, let's say, prototyping and experimentation that mm-hmm. are more focused on AI in particular.
Yeah. Are the people that MSF serves, is it pretty broad? My impression has always been a lot of it is boots on the ground kind of helping people. But from what you're saying, it also sounds like it's serving the research community, the doctor community, the healthcare provider community, in addition to the actual people who get the services. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. There are research organizations within MSF that are focused on doing research. And these kinds of publications are exactly the kinds of things that would appear in this science portal. And it's part of the critical work that MSF does too.
Yeah. What parts of your linguistic training do you think are being used the most in your current job?
Yeah, I think that certainly in a number of different ways. One is just I work with many colleagues from around the world, even though I am primarily working in English, understanding the different kind of linguistic perspectives and that people have, I think is a real asset because translation, even when you're translating ideas, as a technologist into something that is, more accessible to lay people, or in translation itself from one language to another, and a sort of awareness of how language shows up for people, is a constant thing that people are navigating. Mm-hmm. And it's, important to navigate it because it allows for this kind of coordination and collaboration at scale that really leads to remarkable things. But that I'd say is an everyday kind of thing. And then in more tangible ways, when thinking about working on, let's say, machine translation or mm-hmm. Evaluating the kinds of content that might come out of AI and machine translation, that's a way of very directly kind of putting on a linguist and a computational linguist's hat into the work.
Mm. Oh, that's so cool. It must feel very fulfilling. I mean, I can imagine it is. Just being able to do something where you feel like you're having a tangible impact on the world.
Yeah, I am. I am very happy with the change. And I think, I'm also happy for sort of the winding path to get here. I learned so much along the way. I don't think that I would have been the same person if I just started at Doctors Without Borders earlier. So I'm really appreciative of the skills and the experiences that I had really at each place that I worked. I will say, I think one of the things that has really been helpful up to now is just actually working in a variety of different places. Mm-hmm. Realizing that, you can, you really can learn something deeply, within a few years, but that also that there's a lot to learn by going to a new place in terms mm-hmm. of how people work, how they collaborate, how to get stuff done, and how decisions are made. Yeah. I think all of that really shows up just in working at an organization like Doctors Without Borders too.
Yeah. Oh, very, very cool. Do you have ambitions for your role there? I mean, it sounds like you have an awful lot of responsibility. I'll say that. But do you see being able to expand the parts of your program or do other things that's under your direction?
I feel like I can really honestly say that, I'm most interested in impact. I'm very happy with my colleagues and where my role is. It's more just how can you make good on the opportunity of being a technologist within an organization like this that's what I think about and what I'm most interested in, and that I find really motivating, which is a bit different than I think what typically happens within a more traditional company. At least certainly with me, that's the case. I think that there's always just this question of, what is the next step or something like it? And I think that too, but more of my next step is around, how does this work create more impact? And I like that alignment. It feels good internally.
Well, excellent. That is really great. Finally, I wanted to see if you had any specific words of advice to people who might be thinking about this as a career path for them. I mean, the first thing that springs to mind as you've just been talking through it is, if you want to go work for this kind of nonprofit, maybe get a few other jobs first and get some good experience, because it'll probably equip you a lot better for the making an impact sort of job. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it certainly feels right to me. It is the path that I took. I'm sure that there are very valid paths, just going directly to it. But I know I'm able to show up better just having had different kinds of experiences leading me there. I think other things that come to mind are, I routinely just being okay with having sort of a multi-hyphenate career, lots of different directions that you can take at once. I've really let language kind of show up in my life, in ways that have surprised even me. One thing we didn't talk about, is just an example of this, is that, I am a part of a game studio, which is a very different kind of career, but that is one that I do part-time on the side now, but is really focused on making games related to language. At different times has been a full-time endeavor, at least for some of us within the studio, and that, that doesn't on paper, have a very clean progression from one role to the next, I really bring it up here because I feel like this is the space to talk about, the many potential, sometimes messy interests that people have that you can, that aren't entirely legible from a resume or an online LinkedIn, but that are part of what it means to be a working person. And so for me, being a game designer kind of on top of all of this is also something that I take seriously and is a way that, being a linguist and someone who is saying things about language kind of shows up in my life alongside, language and technology. And I think embracing that kind of messiness in a career is the only way that I've operated. And to me is the fun in it.
Absolutely. That's 100% true. So many of the folks that I've talked to have had many careers over time, and diverse as being a chef or being a dancer or being a teacher or being a photographer, being a writer, and all of them kind of work together with the interest in linguistics. And those side interests, I don't even like calling them side interests. I will say, other important interests can just lead you in really cool directions and also give you a skill set that maybe you didn't know you had before. And also, it looks good to employers. This is something the Linguistics Career Launch often says to people, like when you're putting your resume together, you should put all that stuff in. If you've got hobbies or things that you do on the side, if you've made some games on your own or whatever, like put it in there, because your employers want to see you as a whole person, that you're not just the degree that you got. Well, like, what do you do for fun? What are you interested in? Because they want to hire somebody who is a well-rounded person and not just for that very specific skill that you have.
Yeah. And I think that it's also an opportunity to really, to translate what you learned in doing into, a way that someone who is not in the details can appreciate, and that is hard, you know, so, you know, there's a skill in doing it well, but I do think is really worthwhile.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. Can you talk about the game thing a little bit more, or is that still all under wraps?
No. Happy to talk about it. Yeah. So you can look at these games and purchase them. They're out in the world. And this game company has been around for nearly 10 years at this point.
Oh, okay. What's it called?
It's called Thorny Games.
Okay.
And it is a game company that is really focused on making tabletop games.
Mm-hmm.
So much more role-playing games, live-action games, physical games. People play them online, but they're sort of experiencing something that was originally intended to be played in person. And we are often making games that have some interesting language component to them. So one of our games, for example, is called Dialect. That is a game with the tagline, a game about language and how it dies. And it's a storytelling game where you kind of tell the story of an isolated community and set of people, their beginning, their rise, and their end. But you do so in part by kind of building up the very special way that they talk together, you know, their dialect. Mm-hmm. And these are the kinds of games that are a bit like Dungeons and Dragons, very different from that rule set and even from, you know, obviously that that subject matter. But the way that you play them is that you get together with a group of people and the point is to tell a really interesting, engaging, immersive story. And that is one example of a game that it's been out in the world for quite a while, translated itself into multiple languages is really an interesting inroad into language conversations for us, for people who, you know, are just gamers and play games because they enjoy them, to people who are actually, you know, university professors, you know, it shows up in universities and on curricula, to museums. It was recently in an exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Tokyo and its Japanese translation as part of an exhibit there that they were running on untranslatable words. It's very surprising just sometimes when you put out a product like this into the world, just where it ends up. I'd say a lot of my more creative side as a linguist, and my other co-designer is a cryptographer, so he also has a perspective on communication. It really kind of shows up in this area of my life too.
This is fascinating. Amazing. I'm just looking at the website now. It's extremely cool. And everybody who listens to this podcast will probably want to play these games because they seem amazing. I am so glad that you brought that up. This is great. Let's see. Thanks so much for bringing that up right at the end there. You saved the best for last. Amazing. This has been so interesting and fun, and I'm so happy to learn about it. MSF is one of my favorite charities. I always try to give as much money as I can because it feels like it's really going towards, as you say, making an impact, like actually having an effect on global health, which is so important right now. Is it okay if I put your LinkedIn profile link in the show notes in case people want to contact you for an informational interview or just to get some advice?
Yes, totally, totally okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I will do that. Well, Catherine, thank you so much for your time today. This has been delightful.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I hope it's useful to people that are obviously, you know, asking questions on their journey to, you know, find what is a career path, you know, as someone who loves language. And I just wish everybody the best of luck in it. It's, you know, and also to appreciate there is some luck there, but that you can make some of your own luck.
Yeah. As they say, chance favors the prepared mind. So if you're ready for it and that luck comes your way, you'll be ready to tackle it.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you. Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.